Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KD&K Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from the Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. I'm Emily Taylor, and I'm hosting today's program, which is being recorded at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Bryson Wells, rising senior at Aspen High School. He will interview John Schwarz, a theoretical physicist. John is the Harold Brown Professor of Theoretical Physics at Caltech, the California Institute of Technology. Along with a few others, he is regarded as one of the founders of string theory. Schwarz was elected a member of the National Academy of Sciences and is a fellow of the American Physical Society. He is a fellow of the MacArthur Foundation, and he received the Dirac Medal of the International Center for Theoretical Physics in 1989. In 2013, he shared the Fundamental Physics Prize with Michael Green for opening new perspectives on quantum gravity and the unification of forces. John has been a general member of the Aspen Center for Physics since the 1980s, serving as the treasurer on numerous committees and as a trustee. He is currently an honorary member. And now we'll get started with the interview. Take it away, Bryson.
Awesome. Welcome. Primarily, I wanted to ask what sparked your interest in physics and how did you, I guess at a young age, decide that this is something that you wanted to pursue?
When I was an undergraduate at Harvard, I knew that I was mostly interested in either math or science, but I didn't have very specific plans for my future. When I entered, I think I was probably felt that I was more likely headed towards mathematics, because that's probably the thing I was best at the time. But in the course of my undergraduate years, I realized that while mathematics was very interesting, that I didn't fully understand what its purpose was and how mathematicians chose their problems. Also, I felt that I wanted to be a little more grounded, and so I decided that while I enjoyed doing mathematics, I would like to find an area where I could apply it to the real world. And physics, or theoretical physics in particular, is exactly that. It's using a lot of mathematics to try to describe how nature operates at a fundamental level. So that seemed like a good direction to head, but I didn't appreciate that until I was maybe a junior or a senior in college. And that led me to apply to graduate schools in physics. And so I became a graduate student then at University of California, Berkeley, where I did research in theoretical physics.
And during this time, when you were a junior or senior in college, what were some of the major topics, issues, breakthroughs happening in the realms of theoretical physics?
Yeah. I really wasn't in a position to know that kind of thing at that point. all of these developments were still pretty far away from where I stood at that time.
What roles did you play in the creation of string theory? It was you and, I believe, four other people that are kind of marked as the founders. So what what did you do?
Sure. So string theory has been most of my career.
For sure.
It's something that arose in the late 1960s, and it grew out of a subtopic in theoretical physics that I was studying as a graduate student.
What is that subtopic?
So my thesis advisor, whose name was Jeffrey Chu, had a program for trying to understand the strong nuclear force.
All right.
Which is the force that holds protons and neutrons together inside the nucleus of an atom. And in a more modern picture, it's the force that holds quarks and gluons together inside protons and neutrons. In any case, we're trying to understand that force. And he had a particular mathematical approach called S-matrix theory for trying to do that. One big breakthrough was in 1968, at which time I had already graduated from Berkeley and was by that time in Princeton, And this breakthrough was a work by Italian physicist Gabriella Veneziano.
All right.
And what Veneziano did was to write down a particular mathematical expression, something called an beta function developed by a mathematician, Euler. So it's Euler's beta function. And he discovered that this particular mathematical expression implemented many of the principles that that Chu and his students had been working on. And that caused a lot of excitement. And so people worked on generalizing Veneziano's formula, and it turned into string theory. So, as I said, I was in Princeton, and I collaborated with various other young people there. And in 1971, I collaborated with a French physicist, André Neveu, who was visiting Princeton. And we found Veneziano's model had turned into a string theory. And we found a second string theory is basically what happened, which had some advantages over the original one of Veneziano. There was another important contribution from a physicist who was then at Yale named Pierre Ramond, who was later a president of the Aspen Center for Physics. So that work was pretty influential in string theory at that time and led to my being offered a position at Caltech by Murray Gell-Mann, who was an important physicist at the time and also played an important role in Aspen. So I moved to Caltech, thanks to Murray's offer, in 1972, and I've been there ever since.
Oh, wow.
And I retired a number of years ago, but I still try to keep involved in research to some extent.
Now, this, was it Veneziano?
Veneziano.
Veneziano. His equation, what was that equation used for? Was that for the weak nuclear force or the strong nuclear force or something like that?
So that's an excellent question. So the program, as I mentioned, was to understand the strong nuclear force, and it was in that spirit that his formula was offered. And it was also in that spirit that my work with Neveu was done. But then what happened was in 1973, a completely different theory of the strong nuclear force was discovered, which had nothing to do with string theory.
Okay.
And that theory was very quickly realized to be the right one. It's called QCD.
Okay.
And so that's, even today, that's the theory of the strong nuclear force, and nobody disagrees with that. So as a result, that's the several hundred people who had been working on this stuff.
Yeah.
Almost all of them stopped working on it when QCD was introduced. But then at Caltech, I had another French collaborator, Joël Cherq, who came to work with me. And we both felt strongly that the string theory was too beautiful to just throw away. It ought to be good for something. Hmm. And we discovered that one of the things that made it bad for describing the nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, was that it predicted the existence of a particle that we know shouldn't be part of the strong nuclear force. And that this particle had very particular properties, which are exactly those required to describe gravity.
Was this your, eureka moment?
Yes.
Yeah.
This was my first of two eureka moments. And so we said, forget about the strong nuclear force. This is going to be a theory of gravity. Now, of course, there was an excellent theory of gravity that Einstein developed in 1917 or 14 called general relativity. But the problem with general relativity was that it was difficult to reconcile with quantum theory, which later developed. And we understood that the gravity that appears in string theory agrees with general relativity when it should.
Mm-hmm.
But it also can be reconciled with quantum theory. So that's what made it exciting. And so at that point, I did feel that I knew what I would be doing for the rest of my career. and that in fact turned out to be the case. So that.
And this was in 73?
74.
74. Yeah. So you said that was your first of two Eureka moments.
Yes.
So what was, let's talk about the second one.
Yeah, so the second one, which was alluded to in the introduction, was 10 years later when I was collaborating with Michael Green. And in the preceding several years, so our breakthrough was in 1984, and in the preceding few years, we had realized that there were actually three consistent string theories, which we called type 1, type 2A, mm-hmm. type 2B. And one of the problems that we were worried about was how you could get something that we looked like the real world out of them. And there were two big problems, at least. One was that these theories require that there should be nine dimensions of space.
Yeah.
And we know there are only three.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer, which we had already anticipated in 1974, is that six of them have to be curled up into a tiny space which is too small to observe. So that's still the modern viewpoint on the extra dimensions.
I remember reading about it. It's like a garden hose, right? That's like coiled, and it looks two-dimensional from one angle, but if you zoom in, you can see the extra dimensions.
Yeah, that's one kind of analogy.
Yeah.
In any case, the extra dimensions would be so tiny that they're unobservable. Although experimentalists look for them, but they haven't found them yet. and my guess is that they're very far from being discovered.
Yeah.
Because they're that tiny. In any case, that we understood, but then the resulting theory that you end up with in four dimensions should agree with the real world. And one of the properties of the real world theory is it doesn't have left-right symmetry. If you look at the world in a mirror, it violates the laws of the weak nuclear force. The weak nuclear force makes a distinction between left and right. So the question arose, can any of our string theories give rise to something with this left-right symmetry broken?
All right.
And among the theories we were looking at, two of these three could have that property in 10 dimensions, but the question is whether it would survive in four dimensions and whether it would be consistent with the quantum interpretation.
All right.
And so in the type 1 theory, it turned out that there was actually an infinite number of theories because you could attach different symmetry structures to it. But only one of those infinite symmetry structures was consistent with quantum theory. And that was a fact that Michael and I discovered here in this building.
Really?
In this building.
What year was that?
1984.
There's this mm-hmm. breakthrough.
In August of 1984. So it's you can figure out how many years ago that is. 39, I think. And so we were very excited about that. And the funny thing is that for 10 years, I've been excited about this program. Mm-hmm. And there were just a handful of people who shared my enthusiasm, Michael being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the theoretical physics community treated us politely, never accused us of being crackpots, at least not to our, at least not to our faces.
Yeah.
And but they didn't show interest. And I think the main reason was that the physicists who were interested in particle physics were different group of people from those who were interested in gravitational physics.
Yeah.
And this was kind of bridging those two fields. So there wasn't a ready audience for it. But that changed following this 1984 discovery, and the field became very popular after that.
So would you say 1984, so it was going to be my next question, is the year that string theory kind of broke into the mainstream and got to be more accepted by the physics community?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And for the first several years of that, there was some outspoken opposition, curiously, from some rather famous people. But the fact is that the field it also attracted a lot of famous people.
Yeah.
And and thrived and produced interesting results. And by now, I think it's fair to say that any department, university that wants to get involved in theoretical particle physics certainly has people who work in this area.
So is there still, I guess, a shroud of controversy around string theory, or is it more generally accepted nowadays?
Yeah. So I think in the professional world, there's almost no opposition.
That's good.
However, it doesn't, I should say, it doesn't prove that the theory's right. We don't.
Yeah.
We haven't made any experimental predictions
will it
that
ever
have been
be
confirmed. But on the, and the big problem is anything we might predict is likely to be at energies far beyond what can be observed. So it's difficult to confirm experimentally.
Yeah.
So the case of it is largely mathematical, that people are, who can appreciate what it, how it works, find it beautiful, and that's hard to convey. But there were a couple of popular books written a decade or so ago that were rather negative about it.
Hmm.
And for people who are not in the field, it's impossible to form a judgment because all business is highly technical.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what it's about, how can you judge it? These popular books may have affected popular opinion to some extent, but as far as the science is concerned, it's really irrelevant.
Mm.
And those two authors, each, in my view, had some personal grudges for whatever reasons, having
granted
to do with how their careers had developed.
So nowadays, there's still new advancements in string theory. There's some type of string theory where you have to have 11 dimensions, I believe.
Yeah.
Where do you think, I guess backtracking, do you think that string theory will ever be able to be proven either mathematically or through experimentation?
Yes. So what proven mathematically would mean is to convince yourself that the mathematics is rigorous.
Yeah.
And that fully consistent. That would not prove it was correct description of nature.
Okay.
Which is a different question.
True, yeah.
and it's the first question is something a mathematician might worry about. Most physicists are happy that they know understand the math they're doing, even though they do not work with the standards of rigor that mathematicians do. We're willing to take some shortcuts in our reasoning that might make a mathematician uneasy.
Hmm.
But that's the way theoretical physics has always operated. It's nothing new. But it's an interesting fact that in the development of string theory, various people, not me, but various people have made significant advances in mathematics.
Hmm.
So string theory has had a very positive impact outside of theoretical physics, and one of the areas that it has significantly influenced is the development of modern mathematics.
Hmm. So it's kind of like people in the attempt to make advancements in string theory have made advancements, albeit accidentally, in other areas of mathematics?
Yeah, just to develop string theory as it involves an incredible amount of mathematics from all sorts of different branches of mathematics. Mm. I once said, sort of as a joke, it can't be terribly serious, that the one criterion for when mathematics is interesting is whether or not it's relevant to string theory. But because almost all interesting mathematics is relevant to string theory.
Let's see. So what have you been working on in the physics center over the last two weeks, just generally?
Yeah. Okay. So for the last year or so, I've been looking into a topic in theoretical physics, which isn't precisely string theory, but if it's right, it should be incorporated in it. So it's not irrelevant either. And this topic is called celestial holography.
Oh, wow.
And to explain exactly what that is would probably require another
half hour
interview. But it's trying to...
Could you try maybe 2 seconds?
Yeah.
Excuse me, 2 sentences?
Yeah.
Brief description?
So holography is something that arose in string theory, and it has to do with having... describing the same physics in 2 different ways.
Okay.
So you have a theory, say, in n+1 dimensions,
okay,
which is described as some string theory. And then there's going to be another description of the same physics in 1 fewer dimensions, so in n dimensions, rather than n+1 dimensions. And since that's like taking a picture of 3-dimensional space and projecting it on a 2-dimensional surface, which you do with in a hologram,
yeah.
Therefore, this kind of description of physics in 1 higher dimensions in terms of a lower dimensional theory is called a holographic description.
Oh, that makes sense.
Just by analogy with that
okay.
photography business. And so holography has been an important aspect of theoretical physics for the last 25 years.
Mainly concerning string theory, or is it? You said it was separate, right?
Well, it really grew out of string theory, although the person who introduced it, Juan Maldacena, who's a great physicist at the Institute of Advanced Study, and has certainly been here a number of times, didn't emphasize that aspect of it.
And how does it really connect? Does it give us like? I suppose a greater understanding of how the dimensions work with string theory or something like that?
Well, it's stimulated thinking about questions from another viewpoint.
Okay.
And so for certain string theory configurations, which might not be realistic, but are still interesting, are particularly suited for this holography interpretation. Whether anything that is realistic will have such an interpretation, I think, is a completely open question.
All right. Looking back, what do you think throughout your career your greatest achievement has been?
I mentioned the 2 things that the first was recognizing that string theory was theory of gravity.
Yeah.
That was something that was just there to be observed, and it didn't require much doing much, just noticing it.
Yeah.
But still, it was important. And the second thing, which did involve a little more of technical work, was the anomaly cancellation in 1984, which then led to further developments and the widespread acceptance of the subject as an interesting thing to pursue.
Have you been able to see, through your advancements, I guess, the other advancements that have stemmed from what you had discovered? And if so, like, what type of things are we talking about?
Yeah. So 10 years later, in the mid-90s,
there
were a whole series of breakthroughs. And that period is sometimes referred to as the second superstring revolution.
And the first one was in 84?
Yes.
Okay.
There were a lot of interesting things that were learned about string theory at that time. This thing you mentioned about M theory arose at that time. That's one really part of string theory, but it was understood in that second revolution in the mid-90s. And then a little later was the holography discovery that I alluded to, which is also a big breakthrough.
Was that in the 90s as well?
Yeah, that was in 97, I believe.
97.
25 years ago. 98.
And recently, like in the 2000s, maybe stuff that's more happened in my lifetime, has there been any large breakthroughs regarding string theory?
Well, there's been a lot of progress. Perhaps I'm not so well in touch, but there isn't one particular thing that I would single out as standing above everything else. awe in this century. I mean, there's been major developments, but in wide variety of areas.
All right. And how do you think that, I guess, moving forward, string theory is maybe something that I want to get into as far as conducting research and doing stuff like that. What do you think is on the brink? What's on the horizon in the field?
Yeah. It's always hard to know what's going to happen. A discovery of a new particle at the accelerator in Geneva, Switzerland, the LHC, that could revolutionize the field. There's one of the features of string theory is it has a symmetry called supersymmetry, and supersymmetry suggests that there should be particles associated with it, but we don't know how heavy they are, and therefore we don't know whether or not they would be accessible to the accelerator. But if they do turn up, that would be a major breakthrough, which would influence the whole field of particle physics, both theory and experiment.
Wow.
So.
What are those particles called?
Well, there are a whole lot of possible particles that might show up. Supersymmetry basically predicts that every known particle has a partner particle yet to be discovered, which hasn't been observed yet just because they're too heavy to be produced.
That's some very exciting stuff. I can't wait to see what you discover while you're here, and Bryson, what you discover when you go off to college. Maybe you'll discover the new particles. So I just want to say thank you again. Thank you, John Schwartz, professor at Caltech, and our high school intern, rising senior at Aspen High, Bryson Wells. We hope you enjoyed this Radio Physics. For more information about our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org. That's aspenphys.org. Or follow us on social at aspenphysics. Thanks.